I feel like we've suddenly moved to the desert. And we're some nomads in the desert. If at the end of our journey there is no final resting place, then we need not fear losing our way. So we've been talking about these last days, mainly about different forms of connection with nature and connection, touching in with ourself, connection with ourself, the different ways this happens, through embodiment, through feeling the kind of porousness between the outside and the inside. In this way, we've been exploring non-self. Yes. A little bit of connection with others through the eight worldly winds. So I wanted to come back on one thing first before moving on to speaking more of connection with others. Connection with others has been coming up in a lot of the one-to-ones. And I love that, how the theme of the retreats, even if I started to kind of contemplate it a few weeks ago, what am I going to talk about? And I never really decide until the last moment. But then it starts to appear, you know, like when we used to do black and white photography and a thing with chemicals, you know, and slowly the picture appears. And I love that magic of the Dharma in that way. And so this has been appearing. A lot of people have been coming and speaking of connection with others during this retreat, in lives, how to connect authentically with others in our life. Or the sadness when it's not happening. So that's what I would like to share a bit about tonight. I just wanted to have a little parenthesis. I think that's an English word. I'm not sure always. I'm kind of a bit English, not 100%. On this thing of the map, you know, I was speaking of the map as a metaphor for the Buddhist teachings, like a structure, and a reminder that the map is not the territory. As we see, you know, when Anna is walking with the map in a plastic thing, or Yusuf, we know this is not the land. We know it's the map. So it helps, but it is not the land. Okay. And we can't actually experience the fullness of the land just from looking at the map. Hey, it's kind of obvious, eh? And this is the same with the Buddhist teachings. It's a map. It's a really great map, but it's not actually experiencing the teachings. And this is what the Buddha again and again and again, he said, just try it. Just try it. Try it out for yourselves. A little bit like another way of saying it could be that this is not, this I heard from somebody, a nun, and I loved it so much and it made so much sense to me that I like to share it. And that it's like there's a toolbox and it's a great toolbox. But if we get so fascinated with the tools that we're just looking at the tools every day, we take the tools out, you know, we put them out in front and we count them and we polish them and we look at them, but that's not actually doing what you can do with the tools. So this is the same, you know. The map is just the map. The tools are just the tools. And then we can make something with the tools. We can look at the map and we can try out the teachings. And what I so love about these Buddhist teachings, so I know I'm always going on about how in love I am with these teachings, is the autonomy that the Buddha gave back to people practicing, you know, of don't follow me. Don't follow me blindly. Try it for yourself. Don't believe a word I say. Try it for yourself. I mean, you need a bit of faith to try things out, no? To go, okay, I'll be open and receptive and I'll try it out myself. And he kept on saying that to people. And people would come with arguments and stories with their minds and stuff and debate and try to provoke him. And he would say, just try it out. That's the best way. So even with in the Buddha's time, there was many people who would come to debate with him from other holy lineages and stuff, from some wandering holy men. They had all sorts in India. They had many different colors of people into different holy. It was a big time in India then, you know, for all sorts of wacky stuff, a bit like now, you know. There's all sorts of incredible wacky stuff. And so in the Buddha's time as well. And so they would come to argue, try to start an argument with him, you know. Normally kind of inexperimented young ones who didn't have much practice. And around subjects like, so tell us, prove to us that there is life after death. And other ones would come and they would say, prove to us, come on, why, prove to us that there isn't life after death. And so some of them would come and they would prove nihilism, that there was no life after death. And some of them would expound and go, blah, 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 this is why there is life after death. Because it was a Hindu culture, you know. And in the end, the Buddha was like, well, you know, we can talk about this. As they say in English, so he probably didn't say that because he wasn't English, until the cows come home, you know. We can proliferate. We can do papancha, which is verbal, you know, stuff coming out of our heads. We can do this all day long, or we can practice. Because we don't know what's going to happen when we die until we die. So let's not waste too much time with the argument of the head stuff. Let's get on with the practice. And I feel a bit the same. I feel very much the same, especially around that subject of rebirth. So if I die before my friends, people that I know here that have got my phone number, I'll send you a text, yeah? And I'll tell you all about it. So yeah, I wanted to speak more about this connection thing, Sangha, if my hat will stay on. So it kind of reminds me here of that film. I don't know if you've seen it, the Into the Wild. And this young man, he really wants to, he has all these experiences and he wants to really escape from this crazy consumerist society. And he heads out after quite a lot of other stuff happening. He heads out into the wildness of Alaska and he ends up staying in this bus. And he's brought an axe and a gun and he's going to try and survive out there and everything. And he's got a book on plants to eat and stuff. And he's doing pretty well. But then he eats the wrong plant and he starts to get really sick. And at that moment, he reads in a book that he has that actually we need each other. We need people. We need connection. And that it's connection with nature is one thing, connection with ourselves is one thing, but we actually need each other. And that's what's a bit sad, that film, because it's too late, because he's eaten the wrong plant. But I thought it's wonderful. Here we are. We've done Into the Wild, but we brought the people with us. So that's a cool bit, is that we have this part of the retreat that's about connection and this tradition that I would say I've grown up in, this Thai forest tradition, which is a monastic tradition. The main teachings that I've followed is from the monk in that tradition called Ajahn Chah. Ajahn means teacher. And there was already a kind of forest tradition when he was young, but it was very much nomadic. So each monk on his own, wandering in the jungle, and then he would come to a village and he just had his robes and a bowl. And he would come, and the tradition was that the people would give him food. And then he would go back, the monks would go back to the being alone in the jungle and meditate and hope that no tigers ate them. And in the time of Ajahn Chah, once he'd done his training and he became a grown-up monk, with some experience, he was, this isn't really working, you know? Because a lot of these monks, they're not very good at living with other people. So they're almost enlightened, and they think that they're enlightened alone in the jungle. But then as when you put them with other people, it's difficult. They're not so enlightened. They get irritated, you know? So his idea was, what do you say?
How familiar.
How familiar indeed. Hey, isn't it? How enlightened we can feel alone in nature. And then there's the washing up, and it's like, well, it's not my turn to do the washing up, because I did it yesterday. The universal human problem, hey, whose turn is it to do the washing up? So he made a lot of monasteries in his life, and he brought together that very rustic, simple practice, living in the jungle, in monasteries. So there's the living together bit, and then the monks, sometimes you would go off alone on what they call tudong, and they would just wander for a few months, and they would have their alone time, checking in with themselves. And then they'd come back to the communal life, you know? And I think this is why I love that tradition so much, because it's so balanced, that, so realistic about our egos that can easily think, you know, what we are. And then when it comes to other people, can get difficult. And so there's that practice. And I know another monk from that same tradition, and now he lives alone in a very remote place of the jungle. And I listened to a talk by him once, even though I'm not a fan of his. And one thing really stayed with me, and that was that he said, before you can live alone, learn to live with others. Because if you try to live alone before you've worked out the stuff with others, it will catch up with you. You'll just sit there alone in the jungle with all sorts of stuff, papancha coming up in you that's not helpful. And these whirly winds that I was speaking of, they're mainly related to our relationship with others. I mean, pain and pleasure can be happening on its own in here, but it also happens a lot in relationship to others, as does blame and praise, gain and loss, good reputation, bad reputation. It has a lot to do with, you know, how we perceive others, how they perceive us, and our worries about that, which creates quite a lot of suffering. So in working on connection with others, the eight worldly winds are primordial, very important. To work with thing I was talking about the other day, this thing going on, this discernment, you know, this being able to step back a bit from our experience and taste, ooh, that's leading me into suffering. Ooh, that craving that I want this is leading me into suffering. And the other three opposites as well, you know, that good reputation. I want more of it. I lost my good reputation. I'm suffering so much, you know. People thirsty for praise, and then they don't get it where they wanted it, where they expected it. Suffering. I mean, you can imagine, huh? The rest, and on, hey. But this discernment, if we can feel how, when we can see the worldly winds and step back a bit, the muscle of equanimity grows. Our balance and steadiness grows exponentially to how much we can discern. maybe discerning is not the perfect word, but it's the one they use in Buddhism. Sometimes I feel just this is better, you know? This feeling, sensing, touching, you know? What's going on as life falls on us, sweeps us sometimes off our feet, and sometimes just gently. And so take some space when we feel these whirly winds. So I want to tell a story that comes from the Pali Canon, from the Buddhist teachings. Very well-known simile about some acrobats. And so there's a master acrobat and there's the disciple acrobat. And they do an act. And this is really funny because I've worked in a circus for 27 years. So I used to think that this story wasn't really true, that it was kind of wrong because of my circus experience. And then I've been really contemplating it and I realize it's true. But the act is that one person, I can do it. So one person has a belt, yeah, with a pole here. And the other person, who's normally a very small person, goes up the pole and then does balancing on the pole and does all sorts of acts on their head, balancing on one hand, maybe back in those days, one finger, you know, does these things hanging off the pole sideways. There's all this incredible stuff. And so this is the act that they're doing, these two. And so the master says to the disciple, who's a young woman, he says, okay, so you protect me, you look out for me, and I'll look out for you, okay? And the disciple answers back, which is unusual. And she says, no, it is not like this, master. I look after me, you look after you. And so this is like an example of mindfulness, that we can we can protect ourselves and others through looking after our own mind. Through looking out for ourselves. And what I've been watching the last few days when we gather in the circle, you know, before leaving, and then the whole rucksack thing begins, hey. And everybody zips and unzips their rucksack for the next half an hour and opens bags and put things in bag, and then they take it out and they put things in, but they put it, they take their socks off and they put them in there, and they get their chocolate bars out and they put them there, and they get some new paper there. You know what I mean? And we're all getting organized because we need to be organized with these great big things, doing this donkey walk, you know? We can't be having all our stuff all over the place, falling into the countryside, you know? The reindeer are not going to eat our rubbish and our sleeping bags. It's no good, you know? So we need to gather ourselves. So this is what we're doing in the circle. So sometimes I've been a bit like, so I've been here for quite a while. Okay, so this is what we need to do. We need to zip and unzip, zip and unzip. And then finally, everybody's gathered themselves into their thing, and we've got our sacks on, and we can go. And then, because we've gathered all our stuff in, if somebody falls into the mud, like what happened the other day, we can put a hand out and help them, you know, because we're not losing all our stuff, trying to help them, but our sleeping bag's falling in the mud as well, and, you know. So this is like a version of that story. That need to center ourselves so that we can then offer empathy to others. That it's we can't really help others when we're kind of all over the place. It doesn't work. So this is so important, this centering. Mindfully gathering ourselves to be able to share with others, to be able to connect with others. For harmonious cooperation is a nice way of saying it, no? Mm. so that we don't have to argue about who's doing the washing up. We can do things harmoniously. But then back to the acrobats. I need to actually read what I've written, which is difficult. So the disciple has said, "No, it is not like this, master. I take care for myself and you take care for you." And the master then says, this is in a Chinese interpretation, yeah? This is also the meaning of what I say. So he was saying that it's implicit that when we say, "You look after me and I'll look after you," he meant, of course I look after myself. Of course, because, and the same for you, because if you're not centered and focused, you know, I look after myself because if I'm not centered, the pole will fall and you will break your leg. So it's implicit, the mutuality there, which I thought was rather sweet. I suppose in that he trusted that she would understand that implicitness of course, I trust you to look after yourself, you know. And sometimes I suppose that struck me, that thing about the implicitness, because I've noticed that sometimes I just assume, you know, in a connection, in a relationship with someone else, I assume that when I'm proposing something that they know they can say no, you know, but that's not always like that. This is what I've learned. Not everybody knows to say, no, I'm not doing that. No, that doesn't go well with me, no. And so I find that such an interesting area to develop, knowing our own needs and being able to express them, especially if we're coming from some trauma, without putting lava on other people, you know, without our issues, our stuff going onto others. It's a huge learning, I feel, for this time, for these times, to kindly be able to express our boundaries. And so often in very early, when people are working through some really difficult stuff and they're starting to learn to make some boundaries, so they're drawing with their toes in the sand, this is it, this is me, you know, those drawing of boundaries can be quite, they can traumatize other people, you know. So that learning is so important, that no matter what we're going through, that's not the other person's fault necessarily. And the kindness of making our boundaries and saying no, and knowing, no. And I like it that in this story of the two acrobats, that this young woman from all these years ago, 2,600 years ago, that she said no to the master, you know? That she could say, "No, master, you're wrong there." And that he could say, but you know, I knew I could trust you to know that you would look after yourself. So in sangha making, in making our spiritual friendships healthy and strong, there's a huge emphasis in the monastic tradition, which I find is really valid for all situations, for all of us, to not be divisive. To not separate into groups, to not make little groups of people who are against these people, and, you know, this kind of thing is not helpful for any of us. And actually in the monastic tradition, it doesn't matter how much you're right. If you're being divisive, you are thrown out. It's the same as if a monastic breaks a celibacy rule, they are asked to leave. A monastic doesn't stick with the group and creates division in the group, they are out. No matter how right they are about it. Which is all debatable, of course, you know, and we're not in a monastic tradition. I'm just saying that there's something about sangha making a good, strong spiritual friendship potential that is not about divisiveness at all, but about open sharing, open speech. And what we can offer that really helps spiritual friendship and also our connection with others is to offer fearlessness. When we have got to know fear ourselves a bit and what frightens us, there's a lot of stories in the scriptures of monks sitting through the jungle in the night. Because in Asia, there's a lot of, you may know this, no? Trin? There's a lot of stories of ghosts at night. In Thailand, there's a lot of stories that, you know, you must always be inside at night because there are ghosts. And so lots of monks will sit alone through the forest, through the night, to overcome their fear. And so we can find these things for us, where we work on our fears. And once we know fear a bit, we can offer fearlessness to others, which is an incredible dana, an offering. I think it's one of the four things you can offer. You can offer dharma, you can offer fearlessness, and the other two escape me right now. You come back to me tomorrow or in the night. Offering our listening, as we were doing today, listening in presence is sangha making, is finding spiritual friendships. And so as this has been coming up in a few conversations within one-to-ones, where a lot of people actually have a deep thirst for some authentic communication, that learning how to just be with someone in listening and check, is this what you're saying? Is this what you're saying? Is a wonderful way to bond. And the trust of feeling, does this person feel like they're receptive to me being honest and authentic? When we dare to feel if that's a safe thing to do, often people respond with authenticity. So often, people are ready for that. It's surprising. And many people from my previous life, before I was meditating, when I was in the circus world, I didn't see them for 15 years, a lot of people. And and they kind of continued the same sorts of lives, even though they'd grown up and maybe now they're doing, I don't know what, making money in the film business and stuff, because they're too old to be acrobats, by me. But when I meet them, some of them will talk about how they've come close to death or how the death of someone affected them, how they find meaning in life. And I kind of feel like that they don't share that kind of stuff often, but they've heard, oh, Noon went really crazy, you know? Did you hear that Noon left the world and got into meditation? And they're, really, Noon? Oh, that's really strange. And then when I meet with them, they're like, can I tell you about my near-death experience? And, you know, and there's this authenticity that comes. And I'm like I'm so blown out by that. And I'm so touched by that. That these old friends, my old drinking partners, you know, from the old days, want to share something. So it's worth being yourself, because you will get a real response back. And then we also do need to be a bit careful, because some people are just drunk. It's not worth it, you know? It's not worth opening ourselves in some situations, because it's not safe. We might get hurt, you know? So sometimes where I run the retreat center, my family is down in the village close by. So sometimes the retreat finishes and they're all gathered for the summer holidays, you know? And they have big family dinners and they all drink lots of wine and it's very nice. But I don't drink. And sometimes I come and I've been teaching a retreat and everything's been very quiet and kind of vulnerable, you know? We've been taking the armor off. And I come down to the family and then I kind of get knocked over, you know, because they're drinking and it's different. And then I realize, no, I need to go. In some situations, we need to learn to take a bit of protection with us, you know, to take our mosquito hat. So there's discernment as well. Where can I be real? Where is there receptivity? Where can I say to a friend, I need your help? As this has been coming up on this retreat, hey, we've been talking about this in one-to-ones. When can I say, I need your help? When can I say, I like our friendship. Can we keep it? Can we talk about the problem, you know, to do all this? And so often, so with others practicing this empathy from groundedness, from centeredness, like the two acrobats. And in all of our relationships, all of our connecting with others, the theme of non-coercion feels really important to me, that we're allowing the other to make their decision so that we know I have my boundaries, I'm drawing it with my toe in the sand here, but also we know and try to sense where the other persons are so that we're not coercing them. So in particularly in intimate romantic relationships, it's so important to learn that for ourselves, to not be coerced, but also to learn to not coerce other people. And with every being you meet, this can be a practice. In people, how they relate to their children, as we were talking about, allowing them to grow and be themselves, allowing them to find their own responsibility, etc. Even some kid you meet at a station. As our parents get older and more senior, let's say, and we start to treat them a little bit like children because they're losing their memory, I keep reminding myself, no, you know, they're not actually, my mum is not demented. She just has a bit of memory loss, and I need to find out what she really wants, because she's not brought up in an era where you did that. And in the Tibetan teachings, there's an expression that there's a way of practice actually that relies on a belief system, and that is every person I meet is my mother. As in every person, if I've had millions of different lives, every person I meet, I may have had a strong connection with in a previous life. So it relies on the belief that there are many lives, which is one thing, yeah? But the even without the belief in that being an absolute truth, that we have many lives, the practice of that is huge. The practice of meeting every person, maybe somewhere in a dream I knew you, and you know, and we had a strong connection. And therefore, every being I meet, I want to not coerce them into anything. I want to allow them to have their freedom as I want to have my freedom. And we often start out when we meet someone and we fall in love with them. We fall in love with somebody who is often single. Sometimes it doesn't go like that. Often we fall in love with somebody who's single. So in a way, they're kind of free. And what we're falling in love with is their freeness. And vice versa, they fall in love with our freeness. And then we get all tangled up. Our roots get entangled and our lives get entangled. And then it begins the kind of pull with the roots of each person defending their freedom. And we get into some weird stuff. So finding the empathy with groundedness, just like the acrobats. I look after me, you look after you, but also I look after you and you look after me. So I have one last story for the road. So when I had been living in the monastery, the Ajahn Chah Monastery in England for a few years, and The day that I was leaving, I asked for a meeting with the abbot, the main number one Ajahn, Ajahn Amaro. And he was leaving to go to the airport and something, and I was leaving to get the train to London. But he said, yeah, I'll meet you. But you have to be there on time because I have a plane to catch. And I was like, wow, he's going to meet me? Amazing, you know? He's a big, busy abbot, you know? He's got a lot of responsibilities. And so we met in the main dining hall with me, with the rituals, you know, offering the tea, da-di-da. Sitting on the floor, him on the chair, da-di-da. And I was like, so how do we bring it together, you know, the big wide expansiveness, the vibrancy, the aliveness, the non-self, with the kind of life, you know, with the daily life. How do we make this work? Because the daily life, this is not really spiritual practice, no, this daily life stuff. And then there was somebody calling me, hey, no. And I was like, I'm having a meeting with the Ajahn. Go away. And he was like, Noon, come here. And I was like, no, I'm having an important meeting. Shut up, you know? And then the Ajahn says to me, I think you need to go and attend to this, you know? He seems really like he needs to talk to you. So I go to him and I say, what's the problem? And he said, you took my washing out of the washing machine. You touched my washing and now I have to wash it again. And I was like, you know, I was leaving this place that I'd lived in for many years. I was having in the middle of a meeting with the abbot and I was just like, does it matter? So I went back out. And then, you know, 3 minutes later, he calls me again. No, you don't understand. You took my washing out of the washing machine. Now I have to wash it again. And someone else has put their washing in. And rah, 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 rah. I say, I'm so sorry. Oh, I'm so sorry. And I go back to the abbot. And I say, so where were we with how to make it all work? And he said, he was just like, and he had this big grin up to his ears and he was like, that's it. This we can do for the rest of our lives, you know. This is the practice. Thank you for your presence and contribution to this talk by being here with all of yourselves.